Welcome to another episode of Undisciplined. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African and African American Studies program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
We'll be bringing you some of the best of what's happening in academia, taking it outside of the ivory towers, connecting it to what's buzzing in popular culture, and give you our take.
Taking the undisciplined approach of Africana studies outside of the classroom, into the community, and onto the airwaves, we invite you to share in research, ideas, movements of scholars and students, and members of Africa and the diaspora. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get undisciplined! Welcome back to another episode of Undisciplined.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you for joining us again. We're so happy to be with you.
Yes, so happy. I'm really excited for this topic today.
I am too. Oh my goodness, man. You've come right on time. I'm not even going to delay. I'm going to introduce our guest today, who is phenomenal. Our guest today is Alfred Morabia, and he comes overqualified. He completed his undergraduate studies at College Calvin in Geneva in 71, majoring in Greek and Latin. Okay? And after receiving his MD from the School of Medicine at the University of Geneva in 1978, he was trained in internal medicine at the University Hospital of Geneva and in occupational medicine in Italy. He is a board certified in both internal medicine and occupational medicine. In 1986, Morabia received a grant from the Swiss National Science Foundation to study at the Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health, where he obtained his MPH and PhD degrees in epidemiology, the first such PhD awarded to a Swiss citizen. And an MHS in biostatistics. Oh, too many degrees. When did you have fun? In August of 1990, he became the chair of the clinical epidemiology unit at the University Hospital of Geneva, the first epidemiology group ever created in a Swiss hospital, and creates the Bus Santé, the health bus, an ongoing health and nutrition survey of the Geneva population designed after the NHANES. And so, of course, his leadership grew that division, and he was subsequently appointed to professor of clinical epidemiology at the University of Geneva. In 2009, he was appointed a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh, and he's currently a professor of clinical epidemiology in the Department of Epidemiology at the Mailman College of Public Health at Columbia University, New York, and a professor of epidemiology at Barrett Commoner Center for Health and the Environment at Queens College, CUNY, New York. And so he's doing research in urban health and the history of methods, and he's the principal investigator of a cohort study funded by the NIOSH on cardiovascular diseases among men and women who volunteered during the months following the 9/11 attack to clean the debris of the towers, right? He's many grants written on various public health issues, including two books, The Enigmas of Health and Disease, How Epidemiology Contributes to Unravel Scientific Mysteries, published by Columbia University Press in 2014, and then The Public Health Approach, Population Thinking from the Black Death to COVID-19, published in 2023 by Johns Hopkins University Press. And so, guests, we are so thrilled. This is, oh my goodness, right on time,
yes,
doing the peak of what we just went through to talk about all the things.
And
welcome.
This new COVID, right?
Yeah. Welcome, Dr. Morabia.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me. I'm extremely excited to be here.
Oh,
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Who was Barry Commoner?
Oh.
You said I'm a professor of epidemiology at the Barry Commoner Center of City
Center
University.
For Health and the Environment,
yes,
at Queens College.
Who is Barry Commoner?
You tell me. Yeah, tell us. Like it's very pertinent to this discussion.
Was it Commoner?
Yes.
I mean, it's relevant for a couple of aspects. First of all, Barry Commoner at some point had the cover of Time magazine, mm-hmm, for being the American ecologist. And this was in the 60s.
Okay.
And he's been doing a lot of work related to public health. In particular, he was the one who did the baby tooth study, in which he collected teeth from babies from all over the country and measured the content, the radioactive content of those teeth. Hmm. And he showed that actually when there were the experiment with the atomic bombs and in the desert, you
in
know.
Really?
Yes.
For World War II?
No. After World War II, the atomic bombs experiment in the U.S.
Okay.
Los Alamos.
Yes.
Actually, the radiation was going all over the country. And there were a baby who had radiation in their teeth in the East Coast and the West Coast. And he collected all this data, brought them to Lyndon Johnson, who actually stopped at that point the experiment thanks to his work.
Hmm. Oh, my goodness.
I wonder if that's in the presidential library.
He has something more relevant maybe to Arkansas and Oklahoma, is that in 1980, he created the Citizens Party, which was a small party focusing on ecology. Mm-hmm. And he had a vice president. And this vice president was named Harris.
Like does the current VP? Ring a bell?
Yeah, but this Harris was a Comanche from Oklahoma.
Okay.
Wow.
And that was his vice president and the campaign.
Was there a specific reason why he picked a Comanche?
Yeah, because of this ecology and the relationship of the Comanche to
the
environment.
Uh-huh.
And she introduced herself then as a woman of color. Jeez. And that's a relationship between the Barry Commoner Center, which you just mentioned like that.
Yes,
and
the region you're in.
Yeah,
yes.
And it's a native population. So it's my way of acknowledging that I know where I am.
Thank you. Look at you dropping knowledge. And I understand you'll be going to Oklahoma after?
I've been to Oklahoma.
Oh,
I've
you already?
I've seen Oklahoma City. It's mighty pretty.
Oh, really? It's not prettier than Arkansas, though, so you have to admit that on public radio.
No, but that's what Route 66 says in the song, you know?
Are you just making a tour across?
I came to last week on Friday. I arrived in Fayetteville, and I took a car. And I went down to Mena, took the byway, and I stopped in cabins, visited parks, and went on Route 66, got my kicks there. and then I visited Oklahoma University and gave jokes there.
Oh, you gave a talk there.
I love it. It's, you know, what I love the most in this area, I tell you, is not so much the landscape or anything that really struck me, but the people.
Yeah.
Everybody always say that.
So kind, so friendly.
That Southern hospitality.
I love that.
Oh, wonderful. So, I mean, that's a good segue to kind of, is that, it seems like you have a sense of adventure. Is that why you're interested in epidemiology, public health?
What is
why you became
this.
A doctor?
All right. The answer is no, but I'm going to explain to you what brought me to epidemiology. First of all, what is epidemiology? Epidemiology is a science that helps you understand the causes of disease.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what epidemiology does is very simple. It compares groups of people.
Mm.
And when you compare groups of people, then you can understand why they're different.
Right.
And so if you want to know what you know, classics like lung cancer. You compare smokers and non-smokers, you see that those smokers are much more likely to get lung cancer than non-smokers. Or, you know, that's the other thing that epidemiology can do is to know whether a treatment works. You mm-hmm. give it, or whether when you do a screening, you know, whether it really allows you later to prevent some of the lethal form of the disease. So that's mm-hmm. what epidemiology is. It's also a discipline that allows you to know whether social inequities have an impact on health and racism, et cetera. And so what brought me to epidemiology is an old story, because I was a doctor. I wanted to become a doctor in the 1960s. But then when I say 60s, what does it, what comes to your
for
mind?
For us, it's civil rights.
Yeah, civil rights.
Right. Yes.
But not only civil rights. Uh-huh. There was in general, in the young population across the world, there was a kind of aspiration to do something for society, to improve society, reduce inequities, etc. So that's, I wanted to be a doctor, but also have an impact on society.
Right.
And how the switch between the individual approach of a doctor, you know, that has the relationship with one patient.
The bedside manner.
Exactly. To the relationship to a whole population, you switch from an individual to a population. That's what epidemiology brings.
Right.
Epidemiology allows you to work directly with population, like, and it's the basic science of public health. So that's why I went into occupational health, because I wanted to help the working class. And while I was doing that, I discovered epidemiology. And it's such a fascinating...
How did you discover it in the working class?
I was in Italy training, and Italy had the most advanced system of prevention of on the workplace. Uh-huh. They had a health reform, and they had thousands of inspectors who could go into factories, which is very rare, you know. And so for 2 years, I went in all types of factories. And I was telling them, you know, I love that job. And say, yeah, it's a great job, but epidemiology. And so I finally bought a textbook, and it was called Introduction to Epidemiology by someone called Alderson. And it was love at first encounter, I would say. Mm. I loved it, and that's why I asked for a grant, and I could come to the United States and learn it. So that's the reason for the epidemiology.
Why do you think you're so connected to the people and to people and to difference and to understanding difference? What's like the origin story for that development for you?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think I ever thought about it. Just can I look at you when I speak, or should I always?
Yeah,
look
no, you
at
can.
Just try, have the try neck
close to you.
So I can
of try course.
And bounce around the mic like this. So your mouth is still in the mic, but you're kind of turning your neck.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
So move back to you. That's, I never thought exactly that question. What attracts me to people, and that's true that I have a great attraction to people. I like to discover populations, and since I've been an editor, I visited 44 states because I really wanted to know the United States from inside, and I have friends everywhere in all types of. So I don't know exactly why it's. But I think in the 60s, we were taken into those movements, you know, and we knew that together we were more, you know, than each of us separately. And so this idea of communities, of fact that a group of people has its own identity, you know, beyond the identity of every individual inside. It may be something I have integrated, and I still have to do.
Could it have something to do with the fact that maybe you're Swiss? We are the world.
I don't know about that one,
but we are the world of the world, you know. I mean, all the different languages and groups in Switzerland. Yeah, notoriously, I'm Switzerland.
I think this is part of the mythology. I lived in different environments. I lived in Switzerland. I lived in the United States. I've lived in Italy, etc. My very deep feeling is that populations are similar everywhere. Mm-hmm. You find the same type of diversity of characters, of individualities in everywhere. It's also, as a, you know, you mentioned, I'm a historian, but it's one thing that really struck me is that when you think of the history of the human species, you know, whenever you can think of it, whether it's Asia, Africa, South America, North America, Europe, etc., any point in time,
right,
you can imagine that those society. You could have belonged to those societies. There's never a situation where you think these people were really different from me or different from what I've known. And independently of, you know, what part of the world they were, there's a kind of to be a human being and to be able to be functional in society, we don't have a lot of leeway. I think it's really limited. And so everywhere you go, it's the same thing, you know, and you find people you can, you know, be close to, other that are maybe not your favorite, etc.
Different creeds and characters.
So I don't think it would be specific from Switzerland, except maybe one thing. That Switzerland is so small that you tend to go and visit other places, whereas the U.S. are so big, you know? And even this is not true now that I think of, because most of the people I know, they live on the coasts. How many Americans know really
the full U.S.?
The full U.S. and there's a lot of...
How many Americans have left their hometown?
So. True. Yeah. Have used their passport and the privileges that it affords.
Yeah. I mean, the little bit of American exceptionalism there.
You know, when I lived in China, you know, no one believed that I was American because I was black. And they felt that everyone they had seen on TV that was from America was white. And I remember later on, after leaving China, having this conversation with a Brazilian individual. And she was like, well, you could be Brazilian. She could be. They could be Brazilian. Because Brazil doesn't have a face. There's so many different people and faces there.
Brazil think they're raceless.
Not raceless, but there's not a face associated with the race. Exactly. And I think the reason why I asked you that question is, what is your connection to the people? Is because I sense a sense of reluctance in American medicine to want to study the way that culture and racial and national identity impacts health. Do you perceive that same, or what is your perception of America's readiness for that conversation or in medicine?
Yeah, so I think in what you said, American medicine, I would say in general medicine, because, and it's not a bias, but it's what's foundational about medicine is the relationship between a doctor and a patient. So it's an individual approach. When you see your doctor, you're not expecting that person to treat everybody around you. You want that person to be focused on you and your problem. And if they give you some recommendation or treatment, you want to be free to accept it or refuse them, which is what medicine is about. The difference with public health is that public health is a population approach. So it looks at the entire community at once and try to optimize the health in the community.
Okay. Mm.
And if there are inequities, it's really at that level that you change them. Mm. Not so much at the level of the individual.
So not in medicine, but in public health, you would see the issues. Because I'm thinking about, we can connect race to public health and epidemiology in so many critical ways. I'm thinking about the explorations into Africa, right? And even now with all the diseases, Ebola, and hilarious. People thought AIDS came from Africa. Mm-hmm. All the things that has happened, as people have gone, seen it as a tropical hotspot in West and Central Africa, right? As we've seen encroachment into forested areas and the introduction of novel pathogens, mm-hmm. right, with potentially disastrous consequences. I don't know if that's, I've seen theories being preferred that was the cause of the Ebola epidemic. I'm a scholar of Liberia, so, mm-hmm. how Ebola ravaged Liberia and those surrounding countries, all the allegations about what Africans were eating, right? Not mm-hmm. unlike what we've heard here, all the allegations that have been made about Haitians in Springfield, right? And Haitians brought AIDS to the United States. Like the CDC actually had that in their notes at one time. And Haitians had to petition, right? We could think about, all of those things where epidemiology is concerned. So I could see the distinction. So could you think about that, because you in your work, you're talking about the kind of distinctive approach to human health and how it's evolved through trial and error. Has a lot of those trial and error been on Black people?
Mm. Yeah, that's
breaking
that's,
news.
That's for sure, because what you say, which is really interesting and important, raised several issues. They are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues that you are raising when you're talking about the relationship between Africa and America and the rest of the world is an essential concept and characteristics of public health is that it's all inclusive. As a human species, we have to include everyone if we want to be effective mm-hmm. in terms of prevention and improving people.
Because them disease don't discriminate.
So any ideology that segregates, that excludes some part of the human species is incompatible with public health. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting to see that when you talk about public health, you talk about, and you're a public health person, you talk about inclusion. And therefore, the message is how to improve population's health. And when you start talking about exclusion, so what do you do with the population you have excluded in order to protect the rest of the population? You need to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
You need to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. That's why, in Nazi Germany, when they defined some subgroup of the population as being dangerous for the rest and needs to be excluded, they destroy those groups. They
right.
eliminate them.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a theory of against, for example, immigrants,
mm-hmm.
This immigrant can be undocumented. For public health, it's not a...
It's a justification for extermination.
Or to deportation, etc. Mm-hmm. For public health, they're just part of the community. And
right.
whether they have documents or not. Ask the virus.
do you discriminate?
They discriminate between people who have documents. They don't. So that's all inclusivity, including everyone in the population, is a key component of public health. So that's... the second aspect that you raise and question is the biases that may affect public health or medicine. And of course, public health and medicine are part of society. So if you are in a racist society, they're going to be racist too. Mm-hmm. It's not that the public health is isolated. It needs to be under control by the community. But we have plenty of examples in which top-down, you know, forms of public health which didn't incorporate the opinion and of the communities led to disasters. Mm-hmm. And many of them in the United States with population African Americans and population of colors, but also with Mexicans and mm-hmm. with other immigrants and people who were non-whites, because the racist biases, you know, are present as long as you let public health go alone, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all breathing in the smog of racism.
Exactly, and so public health needs to have several characteristics in order to avoid these types of biases. It needs to include everyone, that's one thing, but it needs also to be democratic. It needs to be participatory. Mm-hmm. You know, the people at Tuskegee who had mm-hmm. syphilis and were not told that they could be treated, that there was penicillin, you know, mm-hmm. this was an abuse that wouldn't have existed if the community, the people living in Macon County and who were going to that institute, had been involved. Their representative, their organization had been part of the policy that mm-hmm. the public health service was conducting. Today, same thing. I mean, if you try to do an intervention, even which it could be very positive, but you don't include the community, mm-hmm. you may get very
pushback.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you may fail because you just don't take in consideration key aspects. There is a great example. You know, every example that you explain in 2 minutes, it has to be, you know, mm-hmm. oversimplified. But the idea is there. When the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, who was very favorable to public health, he did a lot for public health, and he was a great mayor from this perspective, wanted to do something very simple, which was to ban very large glasses of soda, mm-hmm. you know, that children could not buy the 21 ounce or something like that, in order to reduce their,
yeah.
their exposure to sugar, etc. And so they could have bought, you know, two small glasses, but not one of those mm-hmm. very large ones. It makes a lot of sense, right? That you don't want kids going around with those large glasses. And the idea was that it would help fighting obesity, mm-hmm, which is a huge problem, in particular, you know, in the Bronx, Harlem. But the community fought against it and got a judge who actually, you know, said that this policy was...
My body, my choice.
And
for real.
But, you know, the policy failed, even though it was absolutely a great thing to do. Mm-hmm. It would have been helpful for the community, but it failed. And so some journalists went to talk to Ben Gillis, who was actually the president of the association, you know, the community association, and said, but what happened? I mean, this is good for you, for the community. Why did you fight it? He said, yeah, we know that's good for the community, but it's not simple. You need to come and talk to us,
yeah,
and we'll do it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't make decisions for us. Make decisions with us. It might be a trust issue.
Yes.
Like, I don't trust you to make these decisions for me. And
look
at
COVID.
I don't trust that your reduction of the size of the bottle isn't coming along with commentary like, yeah, those people just drink too much sugar. And you know, just the ethos of it all.
Mm. Or you're getting a little kickback on the side.
Right, yeah. Right.
You know, so, yeah, and, we talk about COVID, you know, how many people globally in the United States would not take the vaccine because they distrust the government, right? Maybe based on history, maybe based on what they've been reading, but, you know, it was a pandemic. So, you know, making that decision along with the community probably was a issue that couldn't happen at the time, but yeah.
Absolutely. But I want to say something very important about the vaccine and COVID. Mm-hmm. It's been a huge success.
Okay.
Huge success. I mean, there is a lot of things we can criticize. But take Arkansas, take the people 65 year plus, which was the group at highest risk, 83% have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated. 83% is the lowest vaccination rate for 65 year plus in the U.S. Everywhere, you know, the Oklahoma had 85%, et cetera. In the average in the country was 95%. Almost every person 65 year plus has been vaccinated in this country. Mm-hmm. In 2019, you would, before the pandemic, you would have asked, you know, if we have a mandate to vaccinate, what's the proportion of the population, you know, at high risk we would get? Mm-hmm. Nobody would have said more than 40 or 45%. We got 95%.
Mm. You know, I wonder, though, if that's a generational thing. You know, like, so my father and mother, I feel like they experienced this time where vaccinations were just kind of coming out. And I'm military
as
well. You know, so the military stuck every needle in every vaccine. And so I was a vaccinated baby. And so I feel like maybe there is this culture around trusting the vaccination that the government's that the government gives out, whereas a younger generation might not have that same proximity to vaccinations. And so it's not as normal to those folks. But I wonder if there has been a study on the public health of those 65 plus seniors since receiving the vaccination, how things like strokes, heart disease, or any of those things have been impacted by taking the COVID-19 vaccine.
So this we know very well. I mean, there's been very large studies, and they were already available at the beginning when we had the vaccine, that the vaccine was extremely safe. I mean, but safer than most of the things we had known even before. Mm. All those side effects are measured by per million. Of course, there have been, you know, billions of people vaccinated, and so they will maybe have, you know, there were some myocarditis, some thrombocytopenia, some rare, but deaths and were extremely rare. And so this has been, in particular, the RNA-based vaccine were extremely safe. And there's been a report from the National Academy of Science about that, that reviewed all the vaccines. And we don't know much about the latest vaccine, which is based on provides the proteins directly to provide immunity. But on the other ones, and in particular the mRNA base, they were extremely, extremely safe. And we don't have any controversy today about that. No one's raising the issue. Some people say, well, we don't know yet, but we of everything we know and what the science tells us, it's very safe. The other thing that we published in the American Journal of Public Health is the fact, the differences in excess mortality, you know, overall mortality across states. And there's a clear difference where in states where they had more conservative governors, there were more excess deaths, even before the vaccine. So so the measures of physical distancing, of masking, of you know, sometimes school closure, etc., worked, and the vaccine worked.
I think I saw you know, the map you were referencing, those conservative governors and whatnot, and I think people were juxtaposing the when they passed the Affordable Care Act that we know as Obamacare, and what kind of public health impacts did that make, right? And the people in the Jim Crow South, right, who were without proper medical care as opposed to other areas. And I think the COVID map and that that map mapped onto each other perfectly in some kind of way. So it's very fascinating. But can you tell us, you have your recent book published here in 2023, and you're talking about the evolution of public health, how we've approached human health. And you talk about the evolution through trial and error. Could you tell the audience a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah. The reason why I wrote the book, it was not so much this issue of evolution by trial and error, because this was more about the evolution of the methods in epidemiology, which I wrote this book because I felt that the public health approach was not understood by the public at large, because actually, in order to understand public health, you need to make this, you know, mental switch between individual thinking and population thinking. Mm. So
how can you do that in America? We're individual society. It's me.
Absolutely. But there are questions that cannot be solved at the individual level. Mm. And so your best solution is will be derived from an approach by understanding what are the risks for the overall population, because there is no single solution for you. So I saw people saying, well, I can take the vaccine or not, you know, because it's my individual freedom, it's my medical.
Do you want your grandma to die?
but even you know,
that's the propaganda right there.
it's the thing that people thought that medical approach was the same as the population approach, but there is a huge difference, because in the individual approach, you know, when you are in front of your doctor, your decision to take your antibiotic or not affects just you. But when you're dealing with a public health problem, we're all in solidarity. We're all together. So if some people decide not to take the vaccine, it affects the rest of the community. And so it happens that if all the community takes the vaccine, that gives you your best chances. And in order to know that the vaccine is effective and safe, et cetera, you can do studies at the population level. You cannot study anything on an individual. You cannot compare to individual, but you can compare population. You can do prediction about population. There's a science there. And so in order for this, you have to understand.
So it's a matter of scale.
It's when you change scale from the individual to the population, you can all of a sudden have a scientific approach, have evidence, have proofs. And so that's what I explained in this book. The whole about story about public health is to thinking at the population level. And that's what an individual, a human being, cannot understand that if it's not been taught.
Because I get it, but I think I kind of have a ick.
What's your ick?
I mean, I'm amening the population level study. But if someone says, well, this surgery is 85% successful and the population has been 85%, you know, successful, I'm wondering what made the
15% not work.
Yes. And so to me, that sounds like it's coming down to an individual level. And from someone who, you know, whose mother had a stroke following the COVID-19 vaccine, we have no proof. You know, we've done many medical treatments. Was it a heart thing? Was it a brain thing? What could have caused this? You know, it's just a lingering question in our hearts. Like, was this, you know, something that resulted from that? And so on an individual basis, I'm like, but what about my mama?
And we, as Black people, as two black women, we also have to wonder, right? You were talking about inclusion and exclusion, mm-hmm. the tendency of public health and as well as medicine to exclude black people in terms of trials, right?
Yeah.
How many black people was this tested on or was given this medicine us to know?
Or was it just 13% of your sample that represented the black population? Well, no, I need you to do a whole sample of just black people.
Yeah, so when we see that 50%, we're thinking, it was us. We died.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it
Did
makes us
like
very
me?
Nervous.
Were their vitals the same?
But again, I think that there are two different issues. Mm-hmm. One is the population approach,
mm-hmm.
and the other is how to make this population approach effective.
Jail.
And what? Jail?
Jail.
No. Absolutely not.
We can't put them in jail.
It's democracy, it's participation, it's inclusiveness, it's the fact that black women have access to the table and to the decision, mm-hmm. and how things are implemented. And that's why inclusivity is so important in the political instances and where policy is decided, or even how research is developed. This is, you know, democracy, participation, mm-hmm. justice. You know, this without this, public health does not work.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that if you want to protect yourself,
right.
and your family and everyone else you care about from a virus that mm-hmm. is highly contagious,
mm-hmm.
you cannot find a solution yourself,
right.
or your family or the people you care about. It's a community solution. It's a collective solution. Everybody needs to be vaccinated in order for the virus to disappear. As long as it doesn't happen, there is more virus, there is more variants, there's more school closure, there is more small businesses who go bankrupt, and there is more trouble for everyone. And that's, you know, you can only understand that if you understand that populations are more than sum of individuals. They're as collective, you know, they have their own logic. So if enough people are protect themselves, it will protect the whole of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we have data and proofs about that. And I wrote this book to explain that when we grow as human beings, we cannot understand the population dimension mm-hmm. spontaneously
mm-hmm.
because we think in terms of individuals.
Mm-hmm.
In order to view the population dimension, either you need to study data,
mm-hmm.
you know, and,
yes.
and you discover it there, and this mm-hmm. is what happened in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time in the history of humanity, in the 17th century, someone saw that at the population level, you could understand things that could never be solved at the individual
mm-hmm.
level. So that's one thing. But the other, it's when you're taught. You know, I'm trying now to explain you the switch, and you see my hand
mm-hmm.
that does, you know, the switch in the brain from individual to population. My greatest wish and belief is that we need to teach that in high school. So that
people are going to say you're a communist.
Well, I mean, that's not the important.
I don't care. Sticks and stones. No, I understand. We obviously understand perfectly the argument, you know, that you're trying to put, that you're trying to proffer in terms of, you know, sure, we need data, quantitative analysis,
about
the black death, that people are dropping dead, whether it's the black death, Ebola, COVID-19. Yeah, we have to think about that on this broader scale. But I wonder about the possibility, given the politics.
Right.
You know, two things. One, right, we're in a capitalist economy,
mm-hmm.
right? Again, individualism, the individual, the rugged individual, right? In America, right? That's the idea. Pull yourself up by your own bootstrap. Mm-hmm. That's what runs America. And then secondly, can we even overcome the possibility historically mm-hmm. of Black people being non-human?
Right.
That need to be a consideration in these kinds of public health decisions.
I wonder if you're a lone wolf. I wonder even in the study of populations if we're seen as, like you said, significant or important and worthy of study.
Yeah, but again, I think you keep mixing two questions.
Okay.
And one is the issue of justice,
yes.
right? And of inequality. This is a social issue and a political issue, and that's where you solve it. If as long as the society is racist and inequalitarian, et cetera, everything that this society does, including public health, is going to be affected by
right.
it. We need to change it there. But the other thing is when you'd say, I'm individualistic. Okay, what's the best way of protecting yourself? Because one thing I'm sure of, you know, that people want to protect themselves and they want to keep their health. Mm-hmm. And this time with COVID, people have voted with their arms. 95% of the people 65-year-old in the U.S. got two shots of vaccine. 95%. These people showed that they trusted public health because they want to be protected. So how do you protect yourself against something against which individually you're powerless? You can't do anything against COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 as an individual. Mm-hmm. You can only respond collectively. Whether you are a communist, a socialist, a Republican, or whatever, it doesn't matter. That's not the question. There are health issues that can only be solved at the population level. It's also true for cardiovascular disease, for obesity, for diabetes. You change things at the population level. Cardiovascular disease have been going down because, not because people have been eating less fat, but because the meat you were buying had less fat, you know?
Go into that more. Tell us more about, like, so as Black women, you just, diabetes, heart disease, those are some
maternal mortality.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that a doctor issue?
A public health issue.
Well, I know it's a public health issue, mm-hmm. but is it due to doctors, our relationship with our doctors, like he was saying at the beginning, or is it a relationship to just our DNA disposition in terms of, I don't know, our health, our DNA, what I'm wanting to know is how do we collectively solve issues like diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease in the Black community?
Yeah. So again, this is for public health. The public health approach is a population strategy mm-hmm. of prevention. It's not an individual. Of course, doctors may, help treat people, but they will usually deal with the most extreme aspect, you know, of obesity, of diabetes, etc. When you want to change things at the population level, you need to change the habits of the whole population at once. Mm-hmm. So how do you do this? For example, if there is too much salt in the diet, you have a law that forces the industry to reduce the content of salt in all the food you buy. So it's not something you're going to do yourself, but the food you're going to buy is going to be less salted. So all the population, whether they have hypertension or not, will get this.
The benefit
of it. So the whole population is going to be less, have lower blood pressure. Some of them, it was not essential, but it will also bring down the people that were more extreme. If you want to reduce fat content in a population that eats a lot of steaks, etc., you have to produce beef, you know, that are less fatty mm-hmm. than the meat you buy, you know. So it affects the whole population at once. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I think the there are certainly cultural and community aspects that differ.
Epigenetics.
You know, those are very. They don't. We haven't seen situation in which these things mattered.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it matters that people were able to intervene and to say, you know, to have their say about how policy is done, about how they can change things in their communities. So this is real. Otherwise, the difference between, you know, human beings, mm-hmm. whether they are black or white or, you know, Asian, or it's really tiny. It's really tiny. There is a lot of theories about the role of genetics, and it's really, of course, there. But we don't have examples that show that intervening on some specific genetic group, except, you know, really marginal, but at the whole population level, I don't think so.
So I'm hearing you saying that there needs to be like a collective of folks from the black community that needs to be involved in the public health changes in food and drug administration, and to really understand the needs of our community and lobby there for the changes that we need to make individually amongst that will benefit the collective as well.
I wish I would have said that.
Presley and others have made that specific push, I believe, in 2020. And I think this is something that you've picked upon as well in your recent article. As I mentioned earlier, I was at the city council meeting on Tuesday night because in 2020, the city of Fayetteville declared racism a public health emergency, right? And committed to allocating funds to repair harm done to African Americans in Fayetteville. So you recently wrote an article that said that the U.S. presidential election of 2024 is a public health emergency.
Tell us more.
Tell us about that. What advice do you have for the Fayetteville City Council? And what advice do you have for people
for America
so that they can be well-informed voters?
So, give us your Simpson prediction.
The editorial started from an article I read from the ACLU, you know, the Association for Civil Liberties. Which is an association that really, I think, is neutral. I don't think it's partisan. It has criticized and defended the former president in according to the situation. But they listed what we should expect from a new Trump administration based on what they say they would do. And I read that, and I said, you know, deportation of millions of immigrants. You know, what this means in terms of the human harms. We know that because we have public health studies that show what it means and when you start to put immigrants in a situation where they don't have access to public health services. I mean, when there was this public rule, I don't know if you remember that, but there is a public rule that says if you use too many benefits, you know, social benefits for poverty or other reason, then you may not you may not become a citizen. You know, they may decline your right to become a citizen. So the former administration started to threaten. It was not even reality to say that immigrants who would start to use any form of benefit, Medicaid or SNAP or, support for nutrition or for health care, et cetera, they would not be allowed to become citizens. So a lot of immigrants became to not use the services, even though the threat were not yet real. Mm-hmm. Even like that, they didn't, when women were pregnant, they didn't go and get health care and medical surveillance, etc. The weight of babies, of newborn babies in New York City dropped in non-citizens compared to citizens immediately after they started to make those threats. So you can imagine what will happen. Mm-hmm. And when you threaten immigrants of deportation, they're going to go clandestine. Mm-hmm. They won't use services. They won't. And when you have a pandemic,
that causes another public health issue.
So all the problems cannot be addressed when there are health problems. So that was one issue. And then we would have a ban on abortion. Mm-hmm. So we know the consequences of this. We have plenty of studies. And already now, after a year or two after the decision to repeal Roe versus Wade and the federal right to abortion, I mean, the consequences are there. Mm-hmm. Women are obliged to move from one state to another. Mm-hmm. They lose time. They don't have the resources. They end up with the unwanted pregnancy, or they have an abortion much later, or they have emergency situations that are not taken care of, and they die. So we know those consequences. And so I was taking each of those claim that we should expect with a new Trump administration, whether and showing what we know about them in terms of their public health consequences. And so if we don't want those disasters to happen, we need to do something. We need to do something now.
Right. Yeah.
It's not that we have to wait until the transition. We need to do something immediately, because the when I told you about the public health approach and population thinking, etc., it's very important. You know, it's a skill. It's a professional skill. It's something people learn and have the professional skills. These are the people that should be at HHS, at CDC, etc. If all of a sudden we have people like Robert Kennedy, who becomes, important person at CDC. What do you expect in terms of public health?
He's going to cut off whale heads and dump beer bodies in Central Park.
And vaccines.
I don't think about that.
And even baby seats in scar and things like that. I mean, it's all these are huge threats for public health. And that's why I wrote this article. Yeah.
I hear you saying that there's this connection between public health and public works, but are those two in conversation? You know, like I think about public works such as like the water situation in Flint. You know, they just got clean water not too long ago. And when I say clean water, it says the water level is acceptable, you know? So I'm curious about the role that, you know, is there a conversation between, I have two questions. Is there a conversation between public health and folks in public works? And then also, what is the current state of being for public health as it is related to water?
All right. So the answer is yes for the first, and I can develop on the second. But of course, public health includes the environment. I mean, social, but also physical environment. Mm-hmm. All these issues of climate change, of environmental justice, they are completely part of public health. That's how you prevent whole communities to be exposed to some deleterious factors. So everything that is related to disasters, you know, and we've seen with the storms and the hurricanes, etc., everything that is related to access to clean water is completely part of public health. And where public health stands there now, I mean, it's been one of the earliest concern of public health mm-hmm. already in the 19th century to guarantee that people have access to clean water. Mm-hmm. And it remains an extremely important issue now, in addition to the fact that there is a real problem of drought. Of drought. And some populations, some communities now cannot have access to sufficient drink water to get the minimum they should get, you know.
Yeah.
And so the whole issue of access to clean water and sufficient clean water is a huge one today.
It's a, as you said, it's an environmental issue. It's a gender issue.
Social
you think about climate change, and if you think about chores of women and girls
right.
in places in Africa
Ooh.
Or in the Caribbean,
yeah.
gathering water and
yeah.
cooking, if climate change is affecting the spaces where they collect that water, what mm-hmm. it means for them
in terms of water.
Yeah, you know, how are they able to access this? Longer mm-hmm. walking distance, making their lives even more miserable, but also maybe unclean and unsafe water. So the problems in maybe Flint is not so distinct from maybe even Barbados, where the you know climate change is affecting, or even like Ghana, where you know these gender roles happen. So it is fascinating. So, City of Fayetteville, if you're listening, you declared racism a public health emergency, and we have an expert here that has shared critical facts
yeah.
about why this is something that need to be studied and need
and
to be thought
about. And
that
the community, as everyday folks, need to be a part of as well and participating in.
Right. And as representatives of the community,
yeah.
we need to have the language, right?
Yeah.
If there has been, you know, things that they can be done policy-wise, because
mm-hmm.
that's the other interdisciplinary, as an undisciplined podcast, right? That question
yeah.
you just asked, right? It's very, it seems like public health is very undisciplined. Like, there
mm-hmm.
needs to be multiple perspective, environmental,
social, economics, yeah.
all these different, yeah, to
historical.
Think about it so that it can be a holistic approach
yeah.
instead of a one-dimensional approach.
Mm-hmm.
So the pathogens, they don't be operating in an orderly way, you know.
See the boys.
Yeah, we got to come at them from all angles. But what's next for you, Dr. Moravia?
Next for me?
Yes.
Yeah, workaholic.
Maybe we need to put you down as a poet.
No,
rest.
We
rest.
We need him to continue.
Rest
his
is
work.
Revolutionary. That's the solution to all of our public health issues.
Well, maybe the next step is to become undisciplined.
Absolutely. I was wondering, you know, because you operate on so many levels. As we said, you're a physician, you're a professor,
mm-hmm.
you're a researcher, mm-hmm. you run the journal, right? And you have a podcast as well. Are any of those platforms or mediums more preferable for you? Do you prefer one over the other?
What's your favorite place to be in or had to operate under?
Not sure. I think I like... you know, I very much like writing, and so publishing other people's work in writing and making sure that it's clear. I love languages, and I appreciate different, you know, the characteristic of different languages, which I try to speak myself. And I love podcasts because of the interaction, you know, with people, and we go... what I like of this one is that we are in person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's less attractive when we are on Zoom, but
mm-hmm.
It helps me go beyond the articles of my authors and understand their motivation and know more about them. I don't think there is one mean that I prefer.
They all kind of intersect and
yeah,
marry together.
Yeah. They
okay.
all have their own. Interesting twist and characteristic which you cannot get otherwise, you know, writing and talking and yeah.
Yeah.
I write better than I speak, so.
No, I think you're pretty great. Well, undisciplined family, this is an opportunity for you to go home and interact with your family. What are some issues in public health in your community that you, as an individual and as a family, can collectively think about how you can talk with other individuals in your community and understand what you all can do as a collective on the community level to change policies and then, you know, continue to escalate up to the state and up to our national systems and be a part of that and to really amplify our voices. I think this interview is very foundational for helping us to understand that we do have a role and that we do have to analyze what is currently happening within our own lives and be a part of that change. And our voices are very instrumental in creating long-lasting change. So, families.
And just for our audience, Dr. Morabia will be speaking today at the University of Arkansas, giving a lecture in GIFLS tonight. So if you, whenever you've heard this, you know, you can inquire around about, and certainly, you know, buy his book that's available on Amazon and, you know, maybe send him an email, ask him some questions. But it's been... well, whenever you hear about it, you listen to this podcast. But we certainly thank you for coming, and we appreciate all the knowledge that you've given to us and elevating our thinking from the individual to the group level.
Facts. Is that what you want to impart and leave with us? What leave us with one thing?
This is one thing. The switching from the individual to the group level. And the other one is what you summarized this discussion for me is the most important aspect today. I mean, if we want to have a vibrant, strong public health, we absolutely need to develop the bottom-up public health dimension, the communities organizing and being able to negotiate with professionals the way they want to improve things in their community. For me, that's the priority for building a stronger public health than the one we have today. And you, the way you summarized it was perfect, so I cannot go beyond that.
Wonderful.
Well, we thank you for that inspiration, and we hope you're inspired too. So get involved, undiscipliners, and we'll talk to you soon.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Murray Bay.
Thank you for having me.
All right.